De La Pura was the author of a number of books, including Secrets and Lies, Operation Iraqi Freedom, and After, and The Iranian Labyrinth, both published by Nation Books. His articles have appeared in The Nation, The Guardian, and major publications all over the world. He's been a guest on Takes on the World a number of times. I'm happy to have him back here as our guest. Welcome, De La Pura. As the number of dead on all sides continue to pile up in Lebanon's morgues, and the rank of potential terrorists, apart from those in Washington, are on the increase, those responsible for the situation thousands of miles away in the White House are coming under increasing scrutiny and criticism. Until the just-released Bob Woodward book, Beyond Denial, the administration was trying to put a positive spin on allegations contained in a leaked portion of a classified national intelligence estimate that painted a gloomy picture of the situation in Iraq and the future of the region and laid the blame at Bush's door. You were recently commissioned to analyze that document for the Guardian of London, and you came up with some interesting insights and information that was missing from U.S. reporting on the story. I'd like to begin with you telling us what was in the estimate and what the American media and pundits missed.
Absolutely. I think, you know, when this story came out about the national intelligence estimate on Iraq, which was actually, you know, submitted to the White House in April of this year, and of course when the leaks came out, they said, you know, for the first time, this has been leaked, and also because, of course, this is a document prepared by the National Intelligence Council of the USA, which, as you know, has representatives of all the 16 intelligence agencies. And lo and behold, if you look in my book, page 584, actually on January the 14th, 2005, same National Intelligence Council that we are speaking of actually released a report which was a summary of more than 1,000 books and op-eds and comments that experts had written in American as well as non-American. And I can only hope that that list included my book, Secrets and Lies, Operation Iraqi Freedom and After. And their conclusion was twofold. One, that Iraq is creating a new generation of Islamist terrorists, just the way Afghanistan created the first generation of Islamist terrorists who then went on to establish Al-Qaeda. And their second main conclusion was that, unlike what happened in Afghanistan and in the 1980s, when these, you know, militant Islamists had to travel to Afghanistan or maybe part of Pakistan to get training in handling of explosives and weapons, and of course carrying out assassinations and so on, unlike that time, now they don't have to go there because you can pick up these things by accessing the internet. If you access internet in the right website, or if you do the Google on it, you can actually find out how to send and disassemble Kalashnikov and how to handle certain explosives and so on. So therefore they say that this is much more dangerous. Now this report, Jeff, I have to repeat, was published, it's a 119-page report, was published by the NIC, by the National Intelligence Council of the USA, in mid-January 2005. And where are we now? We are talking of, you know, late September 2006, when the leak happened. So apparently, these top officials of the USA, they are not reading their own reports. And that's frightening. And of course, on that particular issue, you probably remember, on the 8th of September, the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee released the second part of the investigation, in which they said clearly that there was no connection between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. And in fact, they went on to say that Saddam Hussein had issued a general order against Al-Qaeda and the recovery. In fact, there was an attempt made to arrest Zarqawi as he was passing through Baghdad in 2002, but which failed. Now, remember that this particular, I'm talking U.S. Senate document, actually was prepared after, you know, their people, you know, their staff had interviewed Saddam Hussein himself, you know, because, you know, he's in jail. as well as his deputy foreign, deputy prime minister and foreign minister Tariq Aziz, as well as they have gone through all the official documents that the Pentagon confiscated after overthrowing Saddam Hussein. So this particular report, as you know, appeared, was released on the 8th of September. On the 9th of September, it was a front page story in the Washington Post, and lo and behold, on the 10th of September, Sunday, when Vice President Dick Cheney is being interviewed by Tim Russert on Meet the Press, he mentioned the U.S. Senate intelligence report. You know what Bill Gates says? I haven't seen this story. At which point, I think, if I were Tim Russert, I would have said to Mr. Cheney, really, Mr. Cheney, will you please take a lie detector test on that? See, I'm giving you another example. Here is an example where it's on the front page of the Washington Post, and this particular gentleman lives in Washington, D.C., and he said that he has not seen the report. Anyway, well, everybody else in the world has read the report, has a summary of the report. So I think basically what I'm saying is that two things. One is that the people in charge are failing in the primary duty of reading their own report, one, and two, you know, because the NIC works very closely with the White House, and two, that when there are important reports by the U.S. Senate or Congress House of Representatives, you know, they simply say we haven't seen it yet. I mean, that is really what you may call, you know, failing to perform the job that you are supposed to do. And you know, that really is frightening. It's frightening. See, basically, what's happened, again, to tie up the two things, is that if you have seen, of course, the summary leaks from Bob Woodward's book, of denial, you know, this Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld, they have cut themselves off from reality. They are not registering reality. And that is something which I think not only Americans, but the people all over the world should worry about, because you have three most powerful persons in the world, and they are not registering reality as it exists, you know, and that is very frightening.
Well, I know Condoleezza Rice still, when she's interviewed, makes statements, connects al-Qaeda with Iraq. In your article, you mentioned also before the 2005 intelligence estimate that in September of 2004, Donald Rumsfeld had asked the Defense Science Board on Strategic Communication to submit a report to him, their assessment of the Iraq War, and it went so badly that he released it on the eve of Thanksgiving that year, so you know, nobody would pay attention to it.
Well, absolutely. I think it's interesting, Jeff, you mentioned that, you know, because what happened, you know, that after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein and basically what I call Anglo-American invasion of Iraq, what happened was that, you know, these guys, I think, realized that their case is not being well received in the Muslim and Arab world. And that is a bit they realized. You know, we have to give them credit to that extent. And so to make it right, Rumsfeld appointed a task force, what's called a Defense Science Board, specially appointed a task force. He appointed the members of the task force on communications. You know, I mean, how should we communicate the outside world, basically Muslim and Arab world, and tell us what we should do. And that committee, of course, worked very hard, and they produced a report, I think sometime in late September 2004, and in which they said two things again, very important. One, they said there is no waiting to be liberated by the U.S. Sentiment in the Arab and Muslim world. One, they simply, you know, said that, unquote, I mean, exact words. And the second conclusion was that they are, they, means bad guys, they are not against, in quote, our way of life, but they are against our foreign policy. They are against our policy, unquote. Now, see, all these kinds of things are the ones which, if you would agree, somebody like me or some other experts who have always opposed the idea of attacking Iraq, etc., have been saying from day one. Now, that's okay. If I say, if somebody else, you know, any person, other liberal programs, radio, TV, commentators say that I maybe operate in the early times or whatever, that's okay. But here is an official report, 119 pages, actually they went through the whole thing, and they said something which Sachin Ramchandra did not like. And so what do you think he did? You know, he just sat on it, and he released it just before Thanksgiving. And who's going to look up the Thanksgiving? You know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday off. So, of course, it is on, it was put on the website. But, you know, how many journalists or commentators would then, you know, take trouble, read it, and then ask questions, because if they want to, you know, question somebody, what should we respond to this and that, they all gone on a long holiday, you see. And so that was the way to basically throw away something which was commissioned specially by no less than Rumsfeld himself. So I think it, all of this could basically, you know, really say something which I think by now should really be taken as an established fact, as well established as to say the sun rises in the east.
Yeah.
That, you know, that these guys, you know, I mean, not that he's got three most important people, and plus, of course, in Condi Rice, since now she's the Secretary of State, they are simply not registering reality. They simply refuse to believe what's going on. In fact, as you know, you saw the great quote in Barbara DeWitt's book, when he said when he interviewed Rumsfeld in July, he had these figures that then say this is getting worse, etc. And this, Rumsfeld refused to acknowledge this is happening. At which point, Woodward simply shakes her head and says, I can't believe this, you know. And then there's another instance again, of course, you know, quite a few books that, you know, have appeared. In one of the books, they went to a full quote from David Kay. Remember, David Kay was a guy who was put in charge to look for WMD, and he prepared a report which was published in October 2004. And David Kay had a meeting with Bush when he prepared his report. And in his own words, David Kay, who's a Republican, diehard Republican, you know, he was really gung-ho against Saddam Hussein, and he went anywhere, looked all kinds of, you know, possibilities of WMD, did not find anything. And he said that when I had a meeting with President Bush, I found somebody at such a high level, totally lacking in inquisitiveness about the WMD. Bush didn't ask any questions. You know, he simply, because he had no interest. Now, he has taken the USA along with the UK to attack a country which was not a threat to anybody, which was, according to no less than Kofi Annan, an illegal war, according to them. And having committed this huge blunder, or I would say, almost stupendous disaster that he has committed, on the basis that Saddam has WMD, and of course the terrorism linked with Al-Qaeda, and the man simply says no interest. That, that particular report, when it appeared, in fact, I remember discussing it with you, I'm talking of David Kay's report, is 1,000 pages long, and I worked out each page cost about it cost about $1 billion, the whole thing, complete from the day one. So each page of that report is worth $1 billion. Chief executive of the USA, the sole superpower in the world, and he takes no interest. You know, he simply, because go back to, of course, you know the quote on my book, you know, God told me to attack Al-Qaeda, and I did it. Then he instructed me to attack, strike Saddam Hussein, and I did it, unquote. So that's it, you know, because he's responsible to God. I mean, the only thing that I often say to myself, or I ask other people, in which language is this gentleman communicating with God, or the other way around? You know, it can't be the text in English.
Well, that's a good question.
I think text in English is too young, you know, it's too fresh. It has to be some ancient language, like, you know, Hebrew or Aramaic, but that he wouldn't book. I mean, Mr. Bush can't even handle English language. How can he handle, an ancient language?
One interesting thing is the timing of Bob Woodward's book, because there has been for some time, although the anti-war movement is not that conscious of it, within the old line Washington establishment represented by Bush's father, C.W. Bush Sr., people like Brzezinski, people like Howard Baker, James Baker, that they see the current administration actually threatening the future of the capitalist system in America by this war and future plans in the region, destabilizing the region. And a book by Woodward is part of the plan by the old line establishment to change forces and put some, not so much so a sanity back into the control in Washington, which is now apparently like going over the cliff with its policies. Does that seem like a likelihood?
You know, that's true. I think essentially, you know, just, you know, in November 7th, we will know what happens, you know, because the Democrats have to win only 15 seats in the House or 6 seats in the Senate to be able to have a majority. And if that happens, and I think, you know, Bush is in trouble, because as you know, that there already is in the USA, of course, you must know, I'm just stating a fact, you know, already the movement of impeachbush.org. And somebody like Nancy Pelosi, if Democrats win the House, Nancy Pelosi, who is the leader of Democrats in the House, she will become a speaker, and she has been anti-war all along, and that's one. And secondly, more specifically, in the House Judiciary Committee, as you know, the senior Democrat, John Cornyn, is the senior guy on that committee, and he is deeply involved in impeach Bush and so on. So I think, and if Democrats get the majority, then of course the composition of the House Judiciary Committee will change and become, you know, a majority of Democrats. And I think then I would say that very good chance of starting impeachment proceedings against Bush. I don't think it'll go through, because of course I don't think 2/3 of senators will go for it. That's what happened in the case of Bill Clinton. But again, to make comparison, in the case of Bill Clinton, all this was involved was, you know, having some kind of a sexual relationship with a woman. You know, that was not a high crime. You know, had, let's put it this way, suppose he had some kind of a sexual relationship with some man or something, that might still have shocked the, you know, general American public. But this, what he did was, you know, just a petty affair. And that was, of course, blown up by the Republicans. He, you know, they put him through the ringer. But again, it failed because there was no 2/3 majority in the Senate. But now, in this case, we really are talking something serious. Because, you know, as you know and I know, the most important thing the chief executive of any country, executive prime minister or executive president, can do is war and peace. War and peace is the most important thing. And if the president has, in my case, actually deliberately, you know, misled and lied to the general public, and look what has happened. And look at the amount of money that has been spent. Look at the amount of people who have been killed. Even the minimum conservative estimates of Iraqi civilians killed run to 55,000. That's the minimum. Others are talking 100,000. And of course, you know, in 2009, about 5% of that number of U.S. soldiers. So remember also, for every American soldier killed, 7 of them are injured. 7 of them. So if there are 2,600, you have something like another 17,000 soldiers who are injured. And of course, all their life, they will have disability payments, and it's going to be extremely expensive for the public funds in the USA. Now, if somebody who has done something so disastrous to such a scale, in terms of money, in terms of life, and of course destabilizing. In fact, basically what he has done is to, you know, work towards, not only unwillingly, it's a breakup of Iraq, and if Iraq breaks up, the whole region is going to be in deep trouble. You know, and remember something else again. See, some of these, you know, books are very interesting. Of course, you know, some bits are very important. About 3 months ago, Peter Galbraith published a book called The End of Iraq, in which he said that there should be partition, and he explained. He is very much on the Kurdish nationalist side. And in that, he said something really quite revealing. In January 2003, the leading Iraqi exile leaders had a meeting with Bush in the Oval Office, and they realized that this gentleman doesn't know the difference between Sunnis and Shiites. He doesn't know that Islam is divided in Sunnis and Shiites. Now, can you imagine that? Now, you see, he is going to invade a country, and he doesn't know basic things that in Iraq, 60% are Shiite and 20% are Sunni, and I guess ethnically different are 20%, or 15 to 16%, and most of them are Sunni. He doesn't know the basic facts, and he's going to invade a country. And, of course, other things we have to remember, because some of these things I'm sure will keep coming up. It wasn't simply the question of overthrowing Saddam Hussein. It was basically to destroy the state machinery of Iraq. Remember also, Iraq was highly centralized, highly efficiently run state machine. Doesn't matter dictatorship or democracy, doesn't matter, because they had oil since 1927. And that money and that, and they fought 8-year long war with Iran. And so the whole country was mobilized, it is, et cetera. It was very tightly run, with a very strong military, police, intelligence, et cetera, et cetera. And the oil industry was strong. Now, that whole machinery was destroyed. See, that's the key point. You remember, as soon as Saddam Hussein's statue was brought down, April 9, 2003, you know, mobs went on and they burned all the ministries, except, of course, oil. And, you know, Americans were just sitting and taking pictures and, you know, standing around with a folded arm, including, of course, you know, the great National Museum of Iraq, which is, shall I say, applies to the whole human civilization, important things in that museum. They were looted and so on and so forth. It was deliberate. The point was that they had to completely destroy, and then, you know, later on, Burma, as instructed by Rumsfeld and Bush, disbanded the whole army, the whole police force, the whole intelligence, all our civil service. And so, now, go back again to the, you know, important people who were involved. Colin Powell said to Bush, if you break something, you own it. See, now, these guys are trying to put the whole thing back together, and they can't do it. So, because, you see, they have, you know, let the genie out of the bottle, is no way you can put it back. See, all of this really shows, and in fact, I can connect the two things, because remember, Bush Jr.'s father, Bush Sr., remember, was the one who, you know, led the, you know, expulsion of Iraqis, you know, war to expel Iraqis from the occupied Kuwait in 1991. Remember, soon after that expulsion took place, you know, Bush Sr. gave a call uprisings against Saddam Hussein, and the Shiites in the South had uprisings. But then Bush Sr. did not help them. He allowed Saddam Hussein's, you know, military to use helicopter gunships, and they, you know, mowed them down, and they, you know, really did the very rough things to the people who rose up against Saddam Hussein. Then Bush Sr. did not do it. Why didn't he do it now? If you were Bush Jr., and if you're going to invade a country, the least you can do is to talk to your dad, because he was there before. Ask your dad. Dad, why didn't you march into Baghdad? Dad would have told him, listen, Sonny, because there was no UN mandate to march into Baghdad. I was doing everything at the UN. Okay, then the son would say, but why didn't you help the Iraqis? I don't think he knows Shiites or Sunnis. Why didn't you help Iraqis who were uprisings against Saddam Hussein? Then he would have said, Sonny, wait a minute. Those guys in the South, they are Shiites. If they had succeeded in their plan and you know, removed Saddam's hand from the south of Iraq, next day they would have become friends with Iran, because Iran is Shiite, and therefore Iran's influence would have been mixed on the border of Kuwait and on the border of Saudi Arabia. Remember Saudi Arabia? They are our friends. You know, Prince Bandar, the Saudi ambassador, He used to come to my place. We would go hunting together. Remember him? Sorry. See what I'm saying? That this gentleman, Bush Jr., did not do some basic things. Basic things. All he had an itch. Attack Saddam Hussein. Attack Iraq. Attack Iraq. And go back again, you know, O'Neill's memoirs.
Well, it's interesting that Tim Russert asked Bush Jr. About his father's criticism of the war, and Bush Jr. answered, "I answered to a higher father." But it was interesting that Bush Sr.'s decision not to remove Saddam Hussein is something that, in a sense, launched this neocon program, Project for New American Century, and letters to Clinton from the neocons and the right wing of the Israel lobby to remove Saddam Hussein under the Clinton administration. And so one of the major principles of parts of the Project for New American Century agenda was the removal of Saddam Hussein. And I think it's quite interesting because the same people today, despite the failures in Iraq, are pushing for a confrontation with the U.S. and Iran. And I want to get into that because you and I have spoken of that before, about the impracticality and the potential disaster for the region and for the world, U.S. troops in Iraq, should the U.S. launch an attack on Iran. And even though they've tried to play it down the media, there was an article in the Sunday Times of London that the U.S. is going to accommodate itself to nuclear Iran, U.S. warships have moved into the Gulf with a USS Eisenhower aircraft carrier. I know in our previous conversations, both you and I had said that there would be no U.S. attack on Iran. How do you feel about that now?
Yeah, that's true. I think very interesting when you said, you know, Sunday Times news story, and also, of course, you know, these Eisenhower has moved on. Basically, what they are doing is, you know, they have, the Pentagon is going to do an exercise that, you know, they will see, is because their fear is that if we attack Iran, then Iran will block a sort of Hormuz through which one third of the world oil moves every day. And so they are going to have these warships to make sure that if that happens, what they would do. They would go through the exercise that the bad guys have done this and this is what we do, or what we should do before, so as to forestall their plans. So that is why they're moving there to do this. Now, in terms of sometimes story, of course, you know, that they said that, you know, there was a meeting of expert on Iran near Washington, most likely at the, you know, Langley CIA headquarters, and the general consensus was twofold. One was what is called a risk to reward factor, and they also realized that if we have to do a job, we have to do 100%, and, you know, destroy all the nuclear facilities, etc., etc. And their major problem is that they don't have full reliable information. Part of that, of course, you know, as I have my book called Iranian Labyrinth, in which I explain that what happened was, and this comes from the book, State of War, by the New York Times correspondent, the National Security correspondent, in which he said that, and of course, this story would be, book would be based on people from the, you know, CIA, National Security Agency, etc., who feel disgruntled, and they will speak off the record. And, but all information is quite reliable. The New York Times has, you know, a very good record of being quite reliable. Anyway, the point is that he points out that in February 2004, of course, CIA had a ring of their agents in Iran. We don't know since when, but they had it working. But in February 2004, you know, what you may call a CIA handler in USA sent a message to, you know, one agent, and in that message, whatever, he had the list of all other agents. And that particular agent who was contacted by whatever means actually was a double agent. So he, of course, acquired the complete list of all the CIA agents in Iran and, of course, passed them on to the Iranian intelligence. And, of course, they swept up the whole ring, but don't expect in Iran there will be any news about it. We got a bad guy. That is out of the question. Anyway, they completely wiped out the CIA ring in Iran in February 2004. I mean, they meaning the Iranian government. And then what happened was that from April 2004, a lot of people in Iran started seeing things in the sky, which you, some people would say UFO, unidentified flying objects, etc., etc. Actually, these are the American, you know, UAVs, you know, unmanned aerial vehicles. And before this sweep up of the human intelligence by the Iranian government, the American intelligence agencies, they were relying on both human intelligence and they were relying on their satellite, you know, this is what we call mechanical air intelligence, surveillance, and combining the two things. But because the human intelligence apparatus was totally destroyed, so they increased the UAVs, you know, the aerial surveillance, to such a large extent that lots of people started to see these things, you know, quite regularly. And then, of course, what had happened is that the Iranian defense system, air defense system, they have actually knocked off a couple of them. But that, again, wasn't published in the Iranian media.
Or the American media.
They did not want the Americans to work out how their system works. So that is something you want to see. That's precisely why the U.S. Eisenhower is going to the Persian Gulf, because they want to see how they will react to this. So I think basically, and I would say as things stand now, I think chances are quite low, because America is totally bogged down in Iraq, and Iran has such strong levers in Iraq, they can make life so miserable the Pentagon that they wouldn't know which way to turn, even as of now. But that doesn't mean, you know, the danger of this repeating the disaster has completely gone away. And just one other thing that you mentioned interestingly, and on that, as you know, in 1996, in fact, 8th of July 1996, Richard Perle, of course, everybody knows he's the guru of the American neocons, and he's also known as the Prince of Darkness. He and his two buddies at the American Enterprise Institute published a paper which is called A Clean Break, Securing the Realm. Now, the realm in this case is not USA. They are U.S. citizens, so this realm is Israel. 8th of July, they published that, they released that paper, and the 2 days later on, the then-Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu publicly said, that is our official policy. Now, what is in that paper, which is similar to that is in my book on Iraq, is two things. One is that between Israelis and Palestinians, forget about the principle of land for peace, it should be peace for peace. That is, the Palestinians should stop, you know, bombing, etc., etc., suicide bombing, etc., etc., and in return, Israel would not beat them up and would not do military action against them. That's one. On the regional side, they said that Israel should strengthen its relationship with Turkey, with which it has a military cooperation agreement, and Jordan, and expand that alliance, triangular alliance, to take care of Syria and Iraq. You know, push things back in Syria, basically, you know, overthrow the Syrian regime, and of course, Iraq as well. You see, that is the particular plan which is being actually implemented. Anybody can actually, you know, look up this thing on a website, you know.
I've talked about that before, the clean break. Yes, Richard Perle, Wormser, and Douglas Feith, and they all got into the government, U.S. government afterward.
Yeah, I think, and again, Jeff, you know, since we're reaching the end of the program, I think, you know, two academics, you know, Stephen Walt and John Mishmeyer, they published their article, Israeli Lobby, which was published in the British magazine called the London Review of Books. Originally, they were commissioned by Atlantic Monthly to do the article, and Atlantic Monthly would not publish it. And the London Review of Books published it, and London Review of Books editor is Jewish. So she said, what's the problem? Why can't we? So I see in that particular article, a very long article, they have given full evidence of the control of Israeli lobby on American foreign policy, especially in the Middle East. You know, and I think that really is something which is worth looking at. And of course, there was such a rumpus, even though that article was not published in the U.S. magazine, it was published in British magazine. Of course, now the internet means we can access these things with very great ease, but that itself created a great protest by people who are, you know, pro-Israel, within America, of course. And so that, again, ties up with what I am saying, you know. See, we mentioned 1991 Bush era, and then, of course, 96, that paper appeared, and those guys, even though they are out of power, you know, Pearl, and, of course, Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld, as well as, don't forget George Shultz, they were all, you know, had some kind of a committee, and that, in fact, was writing letters to Bill Clinton, do this, do that, about Iraq. They're pushing up on Iraq all the time. And you remember also in 1998, U.S. Congress passed a law called Iraq Liberation Act. So they were, even though they were out of power, they were not inactive. They were still pushing against Iraq because Iraq was seen as a threat to Israel. See, Israel at a distance can take care of its immediate neighbors, all of them put together, no problem. And beyond that, beyond Jordan is Iraq. And Iraq is a rather powerful country, oil, and fought war with Iran for 8 years, and a lot of experience of fighting wars, and so on and so forth. So Iraq had to be taken care of, that is, get rid of Saddam. And next to Iraq is Iran, the mullahs, according to the mad mullahs. And that's where, you know, their guns are now pointed to do something about it. But I'm afraid Iran is going to be, I have to say this, Jeff, and I mean seriously, and I know Iran, of course, you know my book, Iran Library. If any action is taken against Iran, what will happen in the region will make Iraq look like a Sunday picnic. Because the Iranians have got a lot of levers to make trouble. Already, one of the low-level intelligence officials had said, because you already know there are 40 targets that America wants to hit in Iran, and so this low-level intelligence official said, we have 29 American targets in Iraq.
If
they are, I'll give you one simple question. You know, the Iranian human rights lawyer, Shirin Ebadi, who got the Nobel Peace Prize in 2003, who hates the regime of Iran, but lives in Iran, fights the system, you know, legally, and she wrote an op-ed in the New York Times Herald Tribune, in which she said, given Iranian's extreme nationalism and the Shiite martyrdom, any military action against Iran will set the whole region ablaze, unquote.
I agree with you completely on that sentiment. I should say Congress has passed, with a pushing written by the Israel lobby, something called the Iran Freedom Act. The future is ominous. Dilip Hira, I want to thank you very much. It was another extraordinary interview with you. Be well.
Yeah, okay. I think, as you know, my two books, one is called The Secrets and the other is called The Iranian Labyrinth.
I want to thank you again for being our guest, Dilip Hira. Take care.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.